Today's Keisha will be on Case 57 in the Book of Equanimity, the Book of Serenity. Case 57 is entitled Yan Yang's Thing. Introduction: playing with reflections, struggling for the form, you don't recognize that the form is the source of the reflection. Raising your voice to stop an echo, you don't know the voice is the root of the echo. If it's not riding an ox looking for an ox, then it's using a wedge to remove a wedge. How can you avoid these extremes? Case: Venerable Yang Yang asked Zhao Zhou, when not a thing is brought, what then? Zhao Zhou said, put it down. Yang Yang said, if I don't have a single thing, what should I put down? Zhao Zhou said, then carry it out. Verse: not prepared for meticulous action, he loses to the first to move. Realizing himself the coarseness of his mind, he's embarrassed at bumping his head. When the game is ended, the axe handles rotted at his side. Clean and purify the ordinary bones, play with the immortals. Today is our second day of our spring sesshin, and I want to thank everybody for doing a wonderful job. I know that the Hardevi has been making a courageous effort, because she's still here. The first sesshin is really quite a challenge, and I've been really impressed by her sitting. There's very little in life which prepares you for sesshin, right? In a certain sense, there's just nothing like this. Many people I know who have gone to sesshin, have told me that it's one of the most challenging things they've ever done. There's a man named John who is a member of our group in Cranford. And he comes to sit sometimes at the Cranford Dance Academy. And he came to a sesshin, I think, in the summer. Maybe it was even August. I'm not sure. I think he came to the August sesshin. And afterward, he said, this is one of the most interesting things that I've ever done. And also one of the most difficult. And sesshin can be a bit of a shock, On the other hand, if you hang in there, around day three, there's going to be a real transformation. Ordinarily we have limits. We say we have our limits. I have limits. And we believe that we have these limits, there are people who come to, introductory classes at the university. And sometimes I'll explain how we're going to meditate for half an hour, and I can see after about 20 minutes they're really straining. After half an hour they're fidgeting and they're hunched over. And sometimes I will tell them that we do retreats where we sit for 9 hours a day, and sometimes their eyes just bug out of their head because they can't even fathom what it would be like to meditate for 9 or 10 hours a day. It seems impossible and unthinkable. But actually, meditation is really quite a remarkable thing. We're slowly, as we grow up, caught in all of these routines, that are very limiting. And it's very hard, as you get older, you see this more and more. It's very difficult for people of a certain age to change very much, Generally speaking, by the time people are, say, 40 or 45, their life is pretty set. Their patterns are pretty set. And as you're growing up, you develop these habits of body and mind, and they become deep ruts in a road. You know, it becomes very hard to get out of them. And, you know, it's very subtle. You know, I know people, for example, who sleep prodigiously. You know, they sleep huge amounts. I've known people like that in college, and I've known people like that in my personal life. People who are just like, they sleep, 10 hours a day. And, I've known people who, my father-in-law is an interesting person. He's 90 years old, and he's on death's door every day. But he gets up at 5 o'clock, even if he's been sleeping all day, and he has a drink. He has a Grey Goose vodka and on ice, right? And so it's kind of comical to see a man who's 90 years old, who sleeps much of the day, get up, and at 5 o'clock it's still cocktail time, you know? And he has his cocktail, you know? And he's been doing that for probably more than 50 years, you know, at 5 o'clock. And in fact, if we go places with him, we have a little electric scooter that's called a Rascal, and we can put him in the Rascal, and he can walk down the street with us. We were in Lambertville the other day because spring was coming in. We had cabin fever. It was like I had to get out of the house, you know. And so we drove over to Lambertville, and we were walking around in the streets over there, and the trees were just about to bud. It was very beautiful. As 5 o'clock approaches, Jack gets more and more antsy, more and more agitated, and he really wants his. It's like he doesn't even have to look at his watch. His whole body is saying. His whole body is saying, cocktail, cocktail, cocktail. This last time we were walking down some streets that we were exploring, and Jack sort of like, turned his Rascal around and started going in the other direction towards a restaurant where he knew he could get a drink. And, come on, come back here, you know, wait just one more block. And he was, you know, it was funny. It was comical, you know. On the other hand, it's so human, right, that we get caught in these routines, it's very difficult to break out of them, even if they make us unhappy, this is just the human way, you know. There was a woman a number of years ago who came to sit with us. And she started doing Zazen, and then I recommended that she do Zazen in the morning. I said, you really should do Zazen in the morning. That's when it's best. And she said, I can't do that. When I get up in the morning, I go on the internet and read all the newspapers online. And after a while, she didn't come back. Actually, that's a terrible way to start the day, if I may say so. If you get up every morning and you read, say, the Huffington Post, I mean, I read these things too, but I don't read them first in the morning. You get up in the morning and you read the Huffington Post, it's usually got a headline like, End of the World Coming, right? Some very, very broad statement about disaster or, the next collapse on the way. Much of the news is very partisan and, political. And almost every article is upsetting in some way or jarring in some way. And you can go read Salon.com, and it's a little less, polemical. If you spend an hour, you can easily spend half an hour going through the online journals and blogs and so on. And when you get up, I defy you to say you feel refreshed and ready for the day, you know. I think what you probably will feel is somewhat angry and somewhat distressed, you know. And so I strongly recommend that you don't do this, you know. And even if you know it's true, you know, even if you sit down and you read the newspapers online and you get depressed or angry, it's stimulating in a strange way, and it's addicting in a strange way. So this is very interesting, right? So it's a hard habit to break. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh, who's probably one of the most successful, one of the most revered Zen teachers, and really one of the most successful. He's reached many millions of people. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh. Left Vietnam when it was falling apart because of the war in Vietnam, and he came here to the United States and went to France ultimately. He has a place called Plum Village in France, this wonderful center, and he writes these beautiful books. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh tells his students don't read the newspaper, and that sounds so escapist, you know, but it's really very good for you not to read the newspaper. At least don't read it in the morning. First thing in the morning, if you want to be happier, do zazen, really. And it's such a different experience, right? I mean, you sit down on the cushion, you start watching your breath, you begin to feel your anxieties become present. If there are anxieties there, they'll become obvious. And usually in the morning, there's fewer anxieties, you know, fewer. And so you sit down on the cushion and the mind is a little more still, a little more clear, and you watch the breath and you watch the breath and thoughts come and go, but little by little, especially if you're not in physical pain, you'll notice that you begin to have this feeling of connectedness or well-being. And then, you know, it stays with you all day long. You know, please try it if you don't do this regularly. It will stay with you all day long. And especially it will stay with you all day long if you make a point of pulling your mind back to the koan or pulling your mind back to your breath. You'll find that it's very renewing, you know. But this is just one example of the ways in which we create mental habits that are very difficult to break. And some of them are physical habits, you know. I myself like coffee, tea, very much, you know. I drink the tea, I have a cup or two in the morning, and I have a cup at work, and then I have a cup after in the afternoon, and I sometimes have two cups in the afternoon. Now, tea isn't bad for me, but I sort of create a little path of tea cups through my day. You know, I have like a little around 10 o'clock. I think, oh, time for my tea. You know, and I'll have some tea, and then around 2:30, it's like, oh. 2:30 time. So I'm not so different from my father-in-law, you know. I have these habits that I've created. Now, you know, sometimes I will do something different, you know. Maybe on a Saturday I'll go out to a place like Lambertville, or maybe I'll go for a hike, you know. And I might get up early and go for a hike up in the mountains. And I might not have my tea. You know, and probably there's some part of me that's saying, where's the tea, where's the tea, you know. Eventually, you know, I get caught up in other things and I realize maybe I didn't need that tea, you know. So Sesshin is a little bit like this. You know, we have a lot of mental habits that we create, and society creates mental habits too. And when we come to Sesshin, we're sort of like purifying, purifying body, heart, and mind. And we think we have these limits. We think we have these boundaries. And we think we have these, we have a sense of what's real and what's not. And when you come to Sesshin, you begin to like reprogram or deprogram yourself. And I think it's a challenge, you know. Sitting on the cushion in pain is a big challenge. And you have a basic flight or fight response to pain, you know. So you're sitting on the cushion, and it just seems like common sense to move your leg. And of course, we work very hard to avoid physical discomfort, you know. We work very hard not to be uncomfortable. Usually when we're uncomfortable, we try to change the environment. I was reading this article that was by some essayist, and he was talking about sitting in a throne in Britain. And he said he had the chance to sit on a royal throne from like the 13th century in Britain. And it was in the British Museum, and I guess he's a curator or something, and he had the chance to sit on it, and he said it was the most uncomfortable chair he'd ever sat in. He said it was unbelievable, and he said he realized that this chair wasn't built for comfort. It was built to impress people. So when you came in the room, you'd see the king sitting in this giant chair, and you'd tremble with fear, you know. And he said it must not have been very important to them that the chair be comfortable. You know, and I think that's quite interesting, you know. So in the modern world, it's all about comfort. It's all about eliminating sources of frustration. So it's a little alien to us to be sitting on a cushion and have pain in our legs and not do something to adjust, to eliminate the pain. It's a kind of mental habit of being comfortable at all times, you know. If you resist that desire to be comfortable, and you focus intensely on your breath, you can sweep the pain away, sweeping the pain away, sweeping the pain away. And gradually you'll notice that it's like there's a shift. It's like you're in a situation where you're trapped, or you're it's claustrophobic. It's like claustrophobia, you know. That my mother had claustrophobia. Apparently, when she was in very tight spaces, she would panic, you know. She couldn't go up into the. We had a little attic in our house, and she would get up there and she'd go, I gotta get down, you know, because she'd have a claustrophobia. As something happened to her that created this karma, where she couldn't take it. You might feel claustrophobic on the cushion, but if you keep focusing on your breath, you know, the most wonderful thing is going to happen to you. It's like your body will drop away, or your body image will disappear, and you'll begin to experience like this bigger body. It's like you begin to experience the world as yourself. And this doesn't happen every time people sit on the cushion, but it happens on the cushion often enough so that people can feel really, it's something you remember, you know. It happens often enough that people keep doing Zen, you know. You sit down on the cushion, you watch the breath, the pain arises. You keep coming back to the breath, and gradually the pain sort of goes off to the side. It doesn't disappear completely, but instead of screaming in your ear, it's like a murmur. And sometimes you can just feel like it's like there's a shell encompassing you, and the shell sort of cracks and opens up. And suddenly you feel like there's no boundary. And you're moving, you know, the sounds around you are part of you. The feeling of the air on your face is part of you. And this is actually a very important achievement when this happens. It may not happen on your first sesshin, but This is like a unified mind, we say in Zen. This is the unified mind in accord with the way. The boundary between the self and the world has disappeared, and you have this wonderful sense of connectedness to things. You know? And so Zen practice is really like breaking out of these habitual, these habits of mind and body that we've created pretty much usually to protect ourselves. We create these routines that protect us, and they can become very inhibiting and very falsely limiting. A lot of these habits are our own making. You know, we have things happen to us that cause us pain and produce fear and anxiety. This is just part of life. And those become deep habits too. So, for example, I've talked about this before, but my father was in the military, and at one time he was stationed at the naval base in Baltimore, Maryland, at a naval base, and I lived in a neighborhood in Baltimore that was okay. There were some apartment houses and we lived in an apartment house there, and it wasn't like a slum or something like that, but the kids were tough. These were tough Baltimore kids, and when I would go to school, sometimes people would want to pick a fight with me, you know, for no reason at all. They just would want to fight me, and I didn't like to fight. So, on my way to school, I would, I would try to avoid certain places, and getting to school always produced a lot of anxiety, you know. Getting home from school produced a lot of anxiety. So, many years later, I still had that anxiety, like on my way to school, you know. Those kinds of things stick with us, you know. And so Zen practice is you could understand Zen practice as a kind of deconditioning process where we're going to sit on the cushion and we're rearranging the body, we're reorganizing the body's energies, and we're going to bring the mind back to the present moment. Maybe it's watching the breath, or maybe it's working with a koan. And if we keep bringing the mind back to the present moment, you begin to have this deep healing. It's really quite wonderful, really quite beautiful. And it will happen. You know, it's like an egg cracking and the chick comes out. Often the things we're struggling with are these mental walls we've created, you know, and they're also physical. They have a physical dimension too. So you can find yourself shaking sometime on the cushion and think, why am I shaking? But it's like you're cracking open the egg and coming out. This can be quite complicated, you know, actually very interesting and complicated. Sometimes you can find yourself worried about things on the cushion that are absolutely trivial, and you can't put them down. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but maybe you're worried about you're sitting on the cushion and you're worried about something like the breathing somebody is making next to you. You know, and this can become like an obsession. You know, I can remember, going through sessions too, and there was some guy, somebody who's a beginner, and he's breathing like, and I would sit down next to him, I remember being at a number of sessions with this guy, his breathing like became this obsession for me, you know, and it bothered me enormously. I really actually sort of like hated this guy a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. and um, and um, you know, really, I think my mind was, I was obsessed with his breathing because I was actually afraid of not answering my koan, you know. I was, and that was, I had deeper fears, you know, behind that fear. You know, I was reading something the other day, you know, sometimes we don't let ourselves see what our real fears might be, you know. We don't let ourselves see what our real fears might be because they're too frightening. You know, so often we're worried about things that are trivial because, the mind is trying to protect us, from something that's more frightening. Isn't that interesting? My sister called me the other day, and it turns out that my nephew, who's a cute little kid, and I'm terrified of him, as a matter of fact, why am I terrified of my nephew? Because the last time I went there, we play a game called Bad Kitty. And basically, he comes into the room and he says, I'm supposed to say, who are you? And he's supposed to say, I'm the bad kitty. And then I'm supposed to chase him. See? And I'm supposed to throw him down on the sofa and tickle him. When I begin to chase him, if I capture him, he'll say, I'm not the bad kitty, I'm the good kitty. The bad kitty's over there. So this is a good game for like a four-year-old, right? And he can play it infinitely, right? It's like he would play Bad Kitty all the time. So the last time I was down there, he loves this game. He'll come in and he'll say, I'm the Bad Kitty. And then I'm supposed to chase him. And then if I capture him, he goes, no, I'm the good kitty. You know, I'm like, toss him onto the bed or something and tickle him and rough him up, and he loves that. And then he'll, you know, it's exhausting for me, right? I mean, after like an hour of Bad Kitty, you know, I'm really ready to throw in the towel, you know. And he's so cute. But when I see him, I actually feel dread. It's like, oh my God, not Bad Kitty again. You know, so I actually was talking to my sister and I said, I'm kind of afraid to come back down because I just can't take another round of Bad Kitty, you know. And she said, oh, but he's 8 now. He won't do that anymore. You know, it's like, oh, okay, you know. I mean, I don't think he's 8, but he's like 7, 6 or something. So. But I'm really afraid of, he really wore me out. It was like at the end of like an afternoon, I just thought, oh my, and nobody else plays with him like that, right? His parents, absolutely not, you know. And there's something else that has nothing to do with the koan, but I have been trying, my sister is a busy health professional. She's a nurse practitioner. She works in an oncology ward, and her husband is a nurse also. And so they have a busy life. They have 2 little kids, and they had them quite late in life. And so my sister has taken the easy way out with these kids. In other words, she feeds them whatever they will eat, and they like macaroni and cheese. They like hot dogs. It's really appalling, right? Hot dogs. They like, and I've said, so anyway, when I'm there, there's a nice Chinese restaurant nearby, and I'll get the things that I usually eat, like green beans and the broccoli, and the little boy, Tyler is his name, he looks with horror on the broccoli. It's like, and I'll go, come on, won't you have just a piece? And he becomes hysterically frightened, right? You know, it's like he's laughing, but he's so nervous. And I'll go, come on, just a piece of broccoli. Here comes the broccoli, you know. And he grabs his mouth. You know, little kids are so great. You know, like, I'm really going to force it. He puts his hands over his mouth and closes tight, you know. And it looks like this slimy green stuff. Anyway, my sister called me up and said, you know, Tyler has OCD, I think. And I was surprised by that because, you know, he seems like such a happy little kid. And She said he's washing his hands a lot. And now he also, he has to wash his hands a lot. He's washing his hands a lot. And also, apparently he does something else too. I can't remember what it is. But it turns out that, there was a boy on the bus who was sitting next to Tyler and was for some, this is just kids, right? I mean, I don't have kids, but I was a kid once, there's a boy on the bus who goes around grabbing other little boys' privates, right? And this is a stage that people go through, I remember my friend Bill Kugler. I went to his house once, and his wife was a psychologist, and they had a little boy, the little boy at one stage was calling everybody wee wee and weenie. He'd say, "Hi, weenie," I didn't know what that meant, but Joyce explained he's going through a stage where he's becoming aware of his privates, I guess, and calling everybody weenie. This boy on the bus was grabbing the little kid's privates, and every day he'd grab Tyler by the privates, and Tyler would go, "My mommy told me you're not supposed to do that," blah, blah, blah. But the kid is a big kid, So anyway, Tyler's coming home and washing his hands extensively, right? And, this is so human, right? It's so human. Everybody does this, So if you're stressed at work, you come home and you think, okay, I've got to have, I know my sister, when she's stressed at work, she has to have a piece of chocolate, And she thinks all day long of the chocolate she's going to eat, it's really not about the chocolate. It's a response to the stress. It's like a displacement, And Tyler's doing the same thing. And we all do, we don't always do it, but we often hide, from ourselves the barriers that we're really struggling with, So a lot of Zen practice is working through the false issue, right? Getting past the thing that we think is bothering us, right? Like a parking ticket we got or something like that. And getting to the real problem, which we might not want to face. It's easier to worry about an unjust parking ticket than it is to worry about maybe a difficult relationship you have with your father or something like that. There's a dimension to this. So some of Zen practice all of Zen practice is really about breaking through these barriers, and we don't even always allow ourselves to see our barriers very well, and we often displace our fears onto other things. And the beauty of koan practice is it gradually lets us see, what we're really struggling with, so this process of Zen, Zazen, is really quite amazing. It's really therapeutic. In Zen, we talk all the time about enlightenment, Daikensho, blah, blah, blah. But actually, Zazen is really about living a happy life. It's really about living a full, happy life. And it's about enhancing human happiness and kindness. That's what Zen is all about. So one way to think about Zazen is, that it's directed towards the enlightenment, and if you go to some Zen centers, it's very much like a military atmosphere, it's easy if you Zen is really not about discipline. It's really not about, crushing through walls. It's not about being tough. It's about living a beautiful life. Zen is all about living a beautiful, happy life. And people can be most happy when they're not afraid, and fear is usually the motivator, and they can be most open when they've worked through their barriers. So Zen is, you know, you could think about a sesshin. This is like a big hospital. You know, this is like, we're coming to sesshin is like coming to Karma Hospital. And as we go, it's Karma Hospital for me too, you know. As we're going through our lives, you know, as we're going through our lives, things happen to us that are painful and difficult, you know. You're on your way to school in Baltimore, and your mother dresses you up like, my mother, grew up on a farm in northern New York State, and she didn't even have shoes at all the time. Now, you know, that's not such a big deal, I guess, but it was a source of shame for her not to have any shoes in the summer. And my mother grew up feeling, you know, my mother was very, my grandparents were very poor farmers, you know. And my mother was very much ashamed. And so when she came in to the city and met my father and they got married, and they wanted to not be poor, low-class people. And so my mother dressed me up like a little British schoolboy. It was insane, really. But my mother, one of my mother's favorite movies, you've probably never seen it, but if you, some night on Turner Classic Television, you might see Little Lord Fauntleroy. My mother worshipped the British, and she wanted me to look like Little Lord Fauntleroy, and she bought like this, she sent me to school in shorts with high socks and a little cap, like a little British schoolboy's cap, in Baltimore. It was like if you put a sign on me that said, kill me, you know, she couldn't have done a better job, right? I mean, it was so bad. And of course, I was a clueless twit, you know. So I go, my mother, this is what mommy says to wear. So I wear this to school and everybody wants to kill me, right? It's like, anyway, you know, it has these kinds of events leave their traces on us, and we don't know why we're frightened, you know, we don't know why, but they're there, and they get displaced, you know, they become a fear of school, or they become a fear of something else, and so I too have, you know, I go to, those experiences don't stop ever in life, right? You take a new job and your boss turns out to be somebody who has Asperger's syndrome, right? And he just looks at you like a bug when you try to talk to him. And the part of the mind that should be having emotional empathy is not operative, right? And he's looking at you like a math problem, right? And so there are such people out there, and they're often in positions of authority, and or you can even, I've actually worked for people that I have positively thought of as sadistic, you know. My first job, when I first got hired at Rutgers, I was called into the office of the chairman, who was this bitter alcoholic man. And his name was Tom Van Land, and he was a chain-smoking alcoholic, and he was this bitter, angry man. And he sat me down and he said, if you don't have a book and three articles when you come up for tenure, you're out of here. You know? And there was no encouragement. It was just like, get cracking or you're dead. You know? And that was terrifying, you know. And I've worked for people who, you know, he was really sadistic, you know, in my opinion. He actually once called me on the weekend. He said, can you drive me home? And I said, what do you mean drive you home? And he said, well, I'm at Charlie Brown's and I've had too much to drink, and if I get caught by the police again, they'll take my license away. So I saw the other side of this guy, right? Very unhappy man. So you know, that took a lot of zazen, right? It took a lot of zazen. I probably wasn't sitting on the cushion initially thinking, I'm terrified of Tom Van Land. I might have been thinking how much I dislike President Bush, you know. But ultimately, I don't really know George Bush, but I do know Tom Van Land, and he was the one who terrified me, right? So you know, we all need to come to Karma Hospital once in a while. We don't have to do it 5 times a year, but coming to Karma Hospital is really important, because we do build up these events in our minds. They leave traces, and they create conditioned responses, just like Pavlov's dog, you know. So if you go to work each day, you're frightened because somebody at work is frightening you. Even if that person retires, when you go to work, you're going to be frightened. It's just simple conditioning. And you can go, oh, I shouldn't be frightened. Tom Van Lan is gone, right? But that's just the little top of the mind. You know, there's a deeper part of the mind that we can't get to with reason. And this is, of course, an insight like of psychoanalysis. And this is why therapy can be very good for people. But also Zazen is like a whole body therapy. And so you sit down on the cushion and you notice that you're edgy and angry, or you notice that you're fearful, or you're fantasizing obsessively about something, right? And you keep trying to come back to your breath and back to your breath and to your breath, and maybe you're working on a koan. And after a while, you suddenly feel sad, or you feel helpless or something. And basically, you think, where are these emotions coming from, right? That you keep coming back to the breath and coming back to the breath. And eventually what's going to happen is it's like that shell cracks and the obstacles fall away. And you feel this deep sense of connectedness and well-being. That doesn't always happen at every session, but the more it happens, it's a great victory. And it starts in a very simple way, just trying to work through pain, physical pain. But if you can work through the pain, and you can push the pain away with the breath, you're going to find this kind of stillness or centeredness. And that will open up into this sense of connectedness, where you suddenly feel even though you're in pain, you suddenly feel very safe, very, very connected, even at peace, even though there's like this toothache of pain, you begin to feel very safe. And when you get off the cushion, you uncross your legs, suddenly you feel this sense of release. You walk around outside and you think, oh, it's so good to be alive, right? And that's really what Buddhism is all about. Buddhism is about, Zazen is not about discipline. It's not about order. It's not about any of those things. It's about happiness. And this is like a school for happiness. And even though you might be in a lot of pain right now, and you might think, well, I'm not very happy right now, happiness is actually difficult to achieve, Happiness is difficult because we have these barriers, right? And so you can go to Hawaii and not be happy, and you can be in your apartment and you can be very happy. And so it's not the circumstances. It's the way you're reacting to the moment. And I'm not saying you shouldn't go to Hawaii if you have the chance, but I'm just saying that it's a fantasy to believe that just being in a certain place makes you happy. If it were that simple, the world would be a happier place. There's an art to happiness. Zen is about the art of happiness. And it has this element of taking down the barriers, getting rid of the barriers. And so that's a little bit of work. But usually when the barriers go down, people feel like $1 million. So, this is day 2 of Sesshin, notoriously the most difficult day. And so if you're having a tough time, don't get discouraged. It's okay to sit in a chair. You're going to feel tired. So during the breaks, get some rest. But if you hang in there until day 3, it's like this beautiful change is going to happen. And you're going to begin to have that sense of connectedness and real joy. And that's why people keep coming back. We have people who have been here for 14 years, our group has a lot of people who have been practicing for a long time, because you get, you know, happiness is better than sadness. I don't know if you've noticed. You know? It's nicer to be happy than to be miserable. It's nicer to be confident and connected, as opposed, it's better to be confident and connected than to be terrified and constantly anxious. Now, the whole culture is based upon, in my opinion, a lot of our culture, not the whole thing. It makes people very anxious. You know, you sell a lot of newspapers by making people anxious. You know, you sell a lot of news stories. You can sell a lot of products by making people feel unhappy unless they have a certain product. So as a educational system goes, our culture is not very healthy. But Zen is very healthy. You know, we get up early with the sun, and we meditate, and we eat very nutritious food, and we're in a actually beautiful environment, right? Everybody here is it wants to be a kind person. Everybody here wants to be a good human being. Everybody here wants to you know, feel love for everybody else here. That's the truth. People wouldn't be here if they weren't trying to be good people. So it's like an ideal situation. You're surrounded by people who are loving and compassionate, or want to be, and you're surrounded by, you know, it's a beautiful spot, it's relatively quiet, spring. You know, and you can think, well, I'm not happy, damn it, you know. But then that's a problem, right? But where's the problem, right? Because, you know, all the ingredients for happiness are actually here. So then we have to get to work, right? We have to get to work. And it's a fantasy to think, well, if I weren't sitting in here in pain, and if I had something besides rice, damn it, to eat, you know, and vegetables, I'd be happy. But that's clearly not the case. But probably if you sit quietly and you feel fear, or you sit quietly and you feel sad, that would be there even if you were in Hawaii. You could distract yourself, but it's not the same thing as overcoming. So this is the school of happiness, and you might think, this is one hell of a way to find happiness. My legs really hurt, you know. But, you know, basically, it's a small price to pay, in my opinion. I've been to Hawaii, and I've spent, you know, a long time on the cushion. And I like Hawaii a lot, but I've been happier on the cushion, actually. I've been, like, deliriously happy sometimes at Sashin. And not delusional, just happy. Now, maybe we don't believe in happiness, but it's very important when you say. So let's cultivate an open heart. Let's connect with reality, with this beautiful world. And if we do that, we're going to be happy. And let's enjoy being alive, you know, because that's what Zen is about. This is about enjoying your life. And it's precious and beautiful. And so, let's do it.